about his neck a scarf of yellow silk. He regarded the prisoners without expression. He gestured slightly with his head toward the rear of the building, and one of the guards took down a ring of keys from the wall, and the prisoners were led out through a dusty weed yard to a small stone building with a heavy wooden door shod in iron. There was a square Judas hole cut into the door at eye level, and fastened across it and welded to the iron framing was a mesh of light-gauge rebar. One of the guards unfastened the old brass padlock and opened the door. He took a separate ring of keys from his belt.
"Let's expose us," he said.
Rawlins held up his handcuffs. The guard undid them, and he entered, and John Grady followed. The door groaned and creaked and thudded shut behind them. There was no light in the room save what fell through the grate in the door, and they stood holding their blankets, waiting for their eyes to grade the darkness. The floor of the cell was concrete, and the air smelled of excrement. After a while, someone to the rear of the room spoke.
"Don't step in the bucket," said John Grady.
"Where is it?"
"I don't know. Just don't step in it."
"I can't see a damn thing."
Another voice spoke out of the darkness. It said,
"Is that you all?"
John Grady could see part of Rawlins' face broken into squares in the light from the grid, turning slowly, the pain in his eyes.
"Ah, God," he said.
"Blevins?" said John Grady.
"Yeah, it's me."
He made his way carefully to the rear. An outstretched leg withdrew along the floor like a serpent recoiling underfoot. He squatted and looked at Blevins. Blevins moved, and he could see his teeth in the partial light, as if he were smiling.
"What a man won't see when he ain't got a gun," said Blevins.
"How long have you been here?"
"I don't know, a long time."
Rawlins made his way toward the back wall and stood looking down at him.
"You told them to hunt us, didn't you?" he said.
"Never done no such a thing," said Blevins.
John Grady looked up at Rawlins.
"They knew there were three of us," he said.
"Yeah,"
said Blevins.
"Bullshit," said Rawlins. "They wouldn't have hunted us once they got the horse back. He's done something."
"It was my goddamn horse,"
said Blevins. They could see him now, scrawny and ragged and filthy.
"It was my horse and my saddle and my gun."
They squatted. No one spoke.
"What have you done?" said John Grady.
"I ain't done nothing nobody else wouldn't have."
"What have you done?"
"You know what he's done," said Rawlins.
"Did you come back here?"
"Damn right I come back here."
"You dumb shit. What did you do? Tell me the rest of it."
"Ain't nothing to tell."
"Oh, hell no," said Rawlins. "Ain't a damn thing to tell."
John Grady turned. He looked past Rawlins. An old man sat quietly against the wall watching them.
"De que crimen queda acusado el joven?" he said.
The man blinked.
"Asesinato," he said.
"El ha matado un hombre?" The man blinked again. He held up three fingers.
"What did he say?"
said Rawlins. John Grady didn't answer.
"What did he say? I know what the son of a bitch said."
"He said he's killed three men."
"That's a damn lie,"
said Blevins. Rawlins sat slowly on the concrete.
"We're dead," he said. "We're dead, man. I knew it'd come to this from the time I first seen him."
"That ain't gonna help us," said John Grady.
"Ain't but one of them died," said Blevins.
Rawlins raised his head and looked at him. Then he got up and stepped to the other side of the room and sat down again. John Grady turned to Blevins.
"I ain't done nothing to him," said Blevins.
"Tell me what happened," said John Grady.
He'd worked for a German family in the town of Palau, 80 miles to the east, and at the end of 2 months he'd taken the money he'd earned and ridden back across the selfsame desert and staked out the horse at the selfsame spring, and dressed in the common clothes of the country he'd walked into town and sat in front of the tienda for 2 days, until he saw the same man go by with the Bisley's worn gutta-percha grips sticking out of his belt.
What did you do?
You ain't got a cigarette, have you?
No. What did you do?
Didn't think you did. What did you do?
Lord, what I wouldn't give for a chew tobacco. What did you do?
I walked up behind him, snatched it out of his belt. That's what I done.
And shot him.
Well, he come at me.
Come at you?
Yeah.
So you shot him.
What choice did I have?
What choice? Said John Grady.
I didn't want to shoot the dumb son of a bitch. That was never no part of my intention.
What did you do then?
Time I got back to the spring where my horse was, they was on me. That boy I shot off his horse throwed down on me with a shotgun.
What happened then?
I didn't have no more shells. I'd shot them all up. My own damn fault. All I had was what was in the gun.
You shot one of the rurales?
Yeah.
Dead?
Yeah.
They sat quietly in the dark.
I could have bought shells and Munoz, said Blevins, before I even come here. I had the money, too.
John Grady looked at him. You got any idea the kind of mess you're in?
Blevins didn't answer.
What did they say they mean to do with you?
Send me to the penitentiary, I reckon.
They ain't gonna send you to the penitentiary.
Why ain't they?
You ain't gonna be that lucky, said Rollins.
I ain't old enough to hang.
They'll lie about your age for you.
They don't have capital punishment in this country, said John Grady. Don't listen to him.
You knew they was hunting us, didn't you? Said Rollins.
Yeah, I knew it. What was I supposed to do, send you a telegram?
John Grady waited for Rollins to answer, but he didn't. The shadow of the iron grid over the Judas hole lay skewed upon the far wall like a waiting chalk game, which the space in that dark and stinking cubicle had somehow rendered out of true. He folded his blanket and sat on it and leaned against the wall.
Do they ever let you out? Do you get to walk around?
I don't know.
What do you mean you don't know?
I can't walk.
You can't walk?
That's what I said.
How come you can't walk? Said Rollins.
Because it busted my feet all to hell is how come.
They sat. No one spoke. Soon it was dark. The old man on the other side of the room had begun to snore. They could hear sounds from the distant village. Dogs, a mother calling, ranchero music with its falsetto cries, almost like an agony played out of a cheap radio somewhere in the nameless night. That night he dreamt of horses in a field, on a high plain, where the spring rains had brought up the grass and the wild flowers out of the ground, and the flowers ran all blue and yellow, far as the eye could see. And in the dream he was among the horses running, and in the dream he himself could run with the horses. And they coursed the young mares and fillies over the plain, where their rich bay and their rich chestnut color shone in the sun. And the young colts ran with their dams and trampled down the flowers in a haze of pollen that hung in the sun like powdered gold. And they ran, he and the horses, out along the high mesas, where the ground resounded under their running hooves, and they flowed and changed and ran, and their manes and tails blew off of them like spume, and there was nothing else at all in that high world. And they moved, all of them, in a resonance that was like a music among them, and they were none of them afraid, horse nor colt nor mare, and they ran in that resonance which is the world itself, and which cannot be spoken but only praised. In the morning two guards came and opened the door and handcuffed Rollins and led him away. John Grady stood and asked where they were taking him, but they didn't answer. Rollins didn't even look back. The captain was sitting at his desk drinking coffee and reading a three-day-old newspaper from Monterey. He looked up.
Pasaporte, he said.
I don't have no passport, said Rollins. The captain looked at him. He raised his eyebrows in mock surprise.
Don't have no passport? He said. You have identification?
Rollins reached around to his left rear pocket with his manacled hands. He could reach the pocket, but he couldn't reach into it. The captain nodded, and one of the guards stepped forward and took out the billfold and handed it across to the captain. The captain leaned back in the chair.
Quita las esposas, he said.
The guard swung his keys forward and took hold of Rollins' wrists and unlocked the handcuffs and stepped back and put them in his belt. Rollins stood rubbing his wrists. The captain turned the sweat-blackened leather in his hand. He looked at both sides of it, and he looked up at Rollins. Then he opened it and took out the cards, and he took out the photograph of Betty Ward, and he took out the American money and then the Mexican peso bills, which alone were unmutilated. He spread these things out on the desk and leaned back in his chair and folded his hands together and tapped his chin with his forefingers and looked at Rollins again. Outside, Rollins could hear a goat. He could hear children. The captain made a little rotary motion with one finger.
"Turn around," he said.
He did so.
"Put down your pants."
"Do what?"
"Put down your pants."
"What the hell for?"
The captain must have made another gesture, because the guard stepped forward and took a leather sap from his rear pocket and struck Rollins across the back of the head with it. The room Rollins was in lit up all white, and his knees buckled, and he reached about him in the air. He was lying with his face against the splintery wooden floor. He didn't remember falling. The floor smelled of dust and grain. He pushed himself up. They waited. They seemed to have nothing else to do. He got to his feet and faced the captain. He felt sick to his stomach.
"You must cooperate," said the captain. "Then you don't have no troubles. Turn around. Put down your pants."
He turned around and unbuckled his belt and pushed his trousers down around his knees, and then the cheap cotton undershorts he'd bought in the commissary at La Vega.
"Lift your shirt," said the captain.
He lifted the shirt.
"Turn around," said the captain.
He turned.
"Get dressed."
He let the shirt fall and reached and hauled up his trousers and buttoned them and buckled back the belt. The captain was sitting holding the driver's license from his billfold.
"What is your date of birth?"
he said.
"September 26, 1932. "What is your address?"
"Route 4, Knickerbocker, Texas, United States of America."
"How much is your height?"
5'11".
"How much is your weight?"
160 pounds.
The captain tapped the license on the desk. He looked at Rollins.
"You have a good memory. Where is this man?"
"What man?"
He held up the license.
"This man. Rollins."
Rollins swallowed. He looked at the guard and he looked at the captain again.
"I'm Rollins," he said.
The captain smiled sadly. He shook his head. Rollins stood with his hands dangling.
"Why ain't I?"
he said.
"Why'd you come here?"
said the captain.
"Come where?" "Here, to this country."
"We come down here to work.
Somos vaqueros." "Speak English, please." "You come to buy cattle?"
"No, sir."
"No. You have no permit, correct?"
"We just come down here to work."
"At La Purísima?"
"Anywhere. That's just where we found work."
"How much did they pay you?"
"We was getting 200 pesos a month."
"In Texas, what do they pay you for this work?"
"I don't know, 100 a month."
$100?
"Yes, sir."
800 pesos.
"Yes, sir, I reckon."
The captain smiled again.
"Why must you leave Texas?"
"We just left. We didn't have to."
"What is your true name?"
"Lacey Rollins."
He pushed the forearm of his sleeve against his forehead and wished at once he hadn't.
"Blevins is your brother."
"No, we got nothing to do with him."
"What is the number of horses you steal?"
"We never stole no horses."
"These horses have no marca."
"They come from the United States."
"You have a factura for these horses?"
"No, we rode down here from San Angelo, Texas. We don't have no papers on them. They're just our horses."
"Where did you cross the border?"
"Oh, just out of Langtree, Texas."
"What is the number of men you kill?"
"I never killed nobody. I never stole nothing in my life. That's the truth."
"Why'd you have guns for?"
"To shoot game."
"Game?"
"Game, to hunt. Cazador."
"Now you are hunters."
"Where is Rollins?"
Rollins was close to tears.
"You're looking at him, damn it."
"What is the true name of the assassin, Blevins?"
"I don't know." How long since you know him? I don't know him. I don't know nothing about him.
The captain pushed back the chair and stood. He pulled down the hem of his coat to correct the wrinkles, and he looked at Rollins.
You are very foolish, he said. Why did you want to have these troubles?
They let Rollins go just inside the door, and he slid to the floor and sat for a moment, and then bent slowly forward into one side and lay, holding himself. The guard crooked his finger at John Grady, who sat squinting up at them in the sudden light. He rose. He looked down at Rollins.
You sons of bitches, he said.
Tell them whatever they want to hear, bud, whispered Rollins. It don't make a damn. Vamonos, said the guard.
What did you tell them?
Told them we was horse thieves and murderers. You will, too.
But by then the guard had come forward and seized his arm and shoved him out the door, and the other guard shut the door and pushed the bolt shackle home in the padlock. When they entered the office, the captain sat as before, his hair newly slicked. John Grady stood before him. In the room, aside from the desk and the chair that the captain sat in, there were three folding metal chairs against the far wall that had an uncomfortable emptiness about them, as if people had got up and left, as if people expected were not coming. An old seed company calendar from Monterey was nailed to the wall above them, and in the corner stood an empty wire birdcage hung from a floor pedestal like some Baroque lampstand. On the captain's desk was a glass oil lamp with a blackened chimney, an ashtray, a pencil that had been sharpened with a knife.
"Las esposas," he said.
The guard stepped forward and unlocked the handcuffs. The captain was looking out the window. He'd taken the pencil from the desk and was tapping his lower teeth with it. He turned and tapped the desk twice with the pencil and laid it down, like a man calling a meeting to order.
"Your friend has told us everything," he said.
He looked up.
"You will find it is best to tell everything right away. That way you won't have no troubles."
"You didn't have no call to beat up on that boy," said John Grady.
"We don't know nothing about Blevins. He asked to ride with us, that's all. We don't know nothing about the horse. The horse got away from him in a thunderstorm and showed up here, and that's when the trouble started. We didn't have nothing to do with it. We've been working for Señor Rocha going on 3 months down at La Purísima. You went down there and told him a bunch of lies. Lacey Rollins is as good a boy as ever come out of Tom Green County."
"He is the criminal Smith."
"His name ain't Smith, it's Rollins, and he ain't a criminal. I've known him all my life. We were raised together. We went to the same school."
The captain sat back. He unbuttoned his shirt pocket and pushed his cigarettes up from the bottom in their package, and took one out without removing the pack, and buttoned the shirt again. The shirt had been tailored in military fashion and fit tightly, and the cigarettes fit tightly in the pocket. He leaned in his chair and took a lighter from his coat and lit the cigarette and put the lighter on the desk beside the pencil and pulled the ashtray to him with one finger and leaned back in the chair and sat with his arm upright and the burning cigarette a few inches from his ear in a posture that seemed alien to him, as if perhaps he'd admired it somewhere in others.
"What is your age?" he said. 16. I'll be 17 in 6 weeks. What is the age of the assassin, Blevins?"
"I don't know. I don't know nothing about him. He says he's 16. I'd guess 14 is more like it. 13, even."
"He don't have no feathers."
"He what?"
"He don't have no feathers."
"I wouldn't know about that. It don't interest me."
The captain's face darkened. He puffed on the cigarette. Then he put his hand on the desk, palm upward, and snapped his fingers.
"Deme su billetera."
John Grady took his billfold from his hip pocket and stepped forward and laid it on the desk and stepped back. The captain looked at him. He leaned forward and took the billfold and sat back and opened it and began to take out the money, the cards, the photos. He spread everything out and looked up.
"Where is your license of operator?"
"I don't have one."
"You have destroyed it."
"I don't have one. I never did have one."
"The assassin Blevins has no documents."
"Probably not."
"Why don't he have no documents?"
"He lost his clothes."
"He lose his clothes?"
"Yes."
"Why he come here to steal horses?"
"It was his horse."
The captain leaned back, smoking.
"The horse is not his horse."
Well, you have it your own ignorant way. Come on. As far as I know, that horse is his horse. He had it with him in Texas, and I know he brought it into Mexico, because I've seen him ride it across the river. The captain sat, drumming his fingers on the arm of the chair. I don't believe you, he said. John Grady didn't answer. These are not the facts. He half-swiveled in his chair to look out the window. Not the facts, he said. He turned and looked across his shoulder at the prisoner.
You have the opportunity to tell the truth here. Here. In 3 days, you will go to Saltillo, and then you will not have this opportunity. It will be gone. Then the truth will be in other hands, you see. We can make the truth here, or we can lose it. But when you leave here, it will be too late. Too late for truth. Then you will be in the hands of other parties. Who can say what the truth will be then, at that time? Then you will blame yourself. You will see.
There ain't but one truth, said John Grady. The truth is what happened. It ain't what come out of somebody's mouth.
Do you like this little town?
Said the captain. It's all right.
It is very quiet here.
Yes.
The peoples in this town are quiet peoples. Everybody here is quiet all the time.
He leaned forward and stubbed out the cigarette in the ashtray.
Then comes the assassin Blevins to steal horses and kill everybody. Why is this? He was a quiet boy and never do no harm, and then he come here and do these things, something like that.
He leaned back and shook his head in that same sad way.
No,
he said. He wagged one finger.
No.
He watched John Grady.
What is the truth is this. He was not a quiet boy. He was this other kind of boy all the time. All the time.
When the guards brought John Grady back, they took Blevins away with them. He could walk, but not well. When the padlock had clicked shut and rattled and swung to rest, John Grady squatted, facing Rollins. How you doing? He said.
I'm okay. How are you?
I'm all right.
What happened?
Nothing.
What'd you tell him?
I told him you were full of shit.
You didn't get to go to the shower room?
No.
You were gone a long time.
Yeah.
He keeps a white coat back there on a hook. He takes it down and puts it on and ties it around his waist with a string.
John Grady nodded. He looked at the old man. The old man was watching them, even if he didn't speak English.
Blevins is sick.
Yeah, I know. I think we're going to Saltillo.
What's in Saltillo?
I don't know. Rollins shifted against the wall. He closed his eyes.
Are you all right?
Said John Grady.
Yeah, I'm all right.
I think he wants to make some kind of deal with us.
The captain?
Captain, whatever he is.
What kind of deal?
To keep quiet. That kind of a deal.
Like we had some kind of a choice. Keep quiet about what?
About Blevins.
Keep quiet about what about Blevins?
John Grady looked at the little square of light in the door and at the skew of it on the wall above the old man's head where he sat. He looked at Rollins. I think they aim to kill him. I think they aim to kill Blevins. Rollins sat for a long time. He sat with his head turned away against the wall. When he looked at John Grady again, his eyes were wet.
Maybe they won't, he said.
I think they will.
Ah, damn, said Rollins. Just goddamn it all to hell.
When they brought Blevins back, he sat in the corner and didn't speak. John Grady talked with the old man. His name was Orlando. He didn't know what crime he was accused of. He'd been told he could go when he signed the papers, but he couldn't read the papers, and no one would read them to him. He didn't know how long he'd been here, since sometime in the winter. While they were talking, the guards came again, and the old man shut up. They unlocked the door and entered and set 2 buckets in the floor together with a stack of enameled tin plates.
One of them looked into the water pail, and the other took the slop pail from the corner, and they went out again. They had about them a perfunctory air, like men accustomed to caring for livestock. When they were gone, the prisoners squatted about the buckets, and John Grady handed out the plates, of which there were five, as if some unknown other were expected. There were no utensils, and they used the tortillas to spoon the beans from the bucket. "Boy Evans," said John Grady, "you aim to eat?"
"I ain't hungry."
"Better get you some of this."
"You all go on."
John Grady scooped beans into one of the spare dishes and folded the tortilla along the edge of the dish and got up and carried it to Blevins and came back. Blevins sat holding the dish in his lap. After a while he said,
"What'd you tell him about me?"
Rollins stopped chewing and looked at John Grady. John Grady looked at Blevins. "Told him the truth?"
"Yeah," said Blevins.
"You think it would make any difference what we told him?" said Rollins.
"He could have tried to help me out."
Rollins looked at John Grady.
"Could have put in a good word for me," said Blevins.
"Good word," said Rollins.
"Wouldn't have cost you nothing."
"Shut the hell up," said Rollins. "Just shut up. You say anything more, I'll come over there and stomp your skinny ass. You hear me? If you say one more goddamn word..."
"Leave him alone," said John Grady.
"Dumb little son of a bitch. You think that man in there don't know what you are? He knew what you were before he ever set eyes on you. Before you were born, damn you to hell. Just damn you to hell."
He was almost in tears. John Grady put a hand on his shoulder.
"Let it go, Lacey," he said. "Just let it go."
In the afternoon, the guards came and left the slop bucket and took away the plates and pails.
"How do you reckon the horses are making it?" said Rollins.
John Grady shook his head.
"Horses," the old man said. "Caballos."
"Si, caballos." They sat in the hot silence and listened to the sounds in the village, the passing of some horses along the road. John Grady asked the old man if they had mistreated him, but the old man waved one hand and passed it off. He said they didn't bother him much. He said there was no sustenance in it for them. An old man's dry moans. He said that pain for the old was no longer a surprise. 3 days later, they were led, blinking, from their cell into the early sunlight and through the yard and the schoolhouse and out into the street. Parked there was a ton-and-a-half flatbed Ford truck. They stood in the street, dirty and unshaven, holding their blankets in their arms. After a while, one of the guards motioned to them to climb up on the truck. Another guard came out of the building, and they were handcuffed with the same plate-worn cuffs and then chained together with a tow chain that lay coiled in the spare tire in the forward bed of the truck. The captain came out and stood in the sunlight, rocking on his heels and drinking a cup of coffee. He wore a pipe-clayed leather belt and holster, the .45 automatic slung at full cock, butt forward at his left side. He spoke to the guards, and they waved their arms, and a man standing on the front bumper of the truck raised up out of the engine compartment and gestured and spoke, and then bent under the hood again.
"What did he say?"
said Blevins. No one answered. There were bundles and crates piled forward on the truck bed, together with some 5-gallon army gas cans. People of the town kept arriving with parcels and handing slips of paper to the driver, who stuffed them into his shirt pocket without comment.
"Yonder stands your gals," said Rollins.
"I'll see 'em," said John Grady.
They were standing close together, the one clinging to the arm of the other, both of them crying.
"What the hell sense does that make?" said Rollins.
John Grady shook his head. The girls stood watching while the truck was loaded and while the guards sat smoking with their rifles propped against their shoulders, and they were still standing there an hour later when the truck finally started, and the hood dropped shut, and the truck with the prisoners in their chains, jostling slightly, pulled away down the narrow dirt street and faded from sight in a rolling wake of dust and motor smoke. There were 3 guards on the truck bed with the prisoners, young boys from the country in ill-fitting and unpressed uniforms. They must have been ordered not to speak to the prisoners because they took care to avoid their eyes. They nodded or raised one hand gravely to people they knew standing in the doorways as they rolled out down the dusty street. The captain sat in the cab with the driver.
Some dogs came out to chase the truck, and the driver cut the wheel sharply to try to run them down, and the guards on the truck bed grabbed wildly for handholds, and the driver looked back at them through the rear window of the cab, laughing, and they all laughed and punched one another, and then sat gravely with their rifles. They turned down a narrow street and stopped in front of a house that was painted bright blue. The captain leaned across the cab and blew the horn. After a while, the door opened and a man came out. He was rather elegantly dressed after the manner of a charro, and he walked around the truck, and the captain got out, and the man got into the cab, and the captain climbed in after him and shut the door, and they pulled away. They drove down the street past the last house and the last of the corrals and mud pens and crossed a shallow ford where the slow water shone like oil in its colors and mended itself behind them before the runoff from the truck tires had even finished draining back. The truck labored up out of the ford over the scarred rock of the roadbed and then leveled out and set off across the desert in the flat mid-morning light. The prisoners watched the dust boil from under the truck and hang over the road and drift slowly off across the desert. They slammed about on the rough oak planks of the truck bed and tried to keep their blankets folded under them. Where the road forked, they turned out onto the track that would take them to Cuatro Ciénegas and on to Saltillo, 400 kilometers to the south. Blevins had unfolded his blanket and was stretched out on it with his arms under his head. He lay staring up at the pure blue desert sky where there was no cloud, no bird. When he spoke, his voice shuddered from the hammering of the truck bed against his back. "Boys," he said, "this is going to be a long old trip." They looked at him. They looked at each other. They didn't say if they thought it would be or not. "The old man said it'd take all day to get there," said Blevins. "I asked him, said all day." Before noon, they struck the main road coming down out of Boquillas on the border, and they took the road down country, through the pueblos of San Guillermo, San Miguel, Tanque el Revés. The few vehicles they encountered on that hot and guttered track passed in a storm of dust and flying rock, and the riders on the truck bed turned away with their faces in their elbow sleeves. They stopped in Ocampo and offloaded some crates of produce and some mail and drove on toward El Oso. In the early afternoon, they pulled in at a small café by the roadside, and the guards climbed down and went in with their guns. The prisoners sat chained on the truck bed. In the dead mud yard, some children who'd been playing stopped to watch them, and a thin white dog, who seemed to have been awaiting just such an arrival, came over and urinated for a long time against the rear tire of the truck and went back. When the guards came out, they were laughing and rolling cigarettes. One of them carried 3 bottles of orange soda water, and he passed them up to the prisoners and stood waiting for the bottles while they drank. When the captain appeared in the doorway, they climbed back onto the truck. The guard who'd taken the bottles back came out, and then the man in the charro outfit, and then the driver. When they were all in their places, the captain stepped from the shade of the doorway and crossed the gravel apron and climbed into the cab, and they went on. At Cuatro Ciénegas, they struck the paved road and turned south toward Torreón. One of the guards stood up and, holding on to the shoulder of his companion, looked back at the road sign. He sat again, and they glanced at the prisoners, and then just sat, looking out over the countryside as the truck gathered speed. An hour later, they left the road altogether, the truck laboring over a dirt track across rolling fields, a great and fallow baldios, such as was common to that country, where feral cattle the color of candle wax come up out of the arroyos to feed at night like alien principles. Summer thunderheads were building to the north, and Blevins was studying the horizon and watching the thin wires of lightning and watching the dust to see how the wind blew. They crossed a broad gravel riverbed, dry and white in the sun, and they climbed into a meadow where the grass was tall as the tires and passed under the truck with a seething sound, and they entered a grove of ebony trees and drove out a nesting pair of hawks and pulled up in the yard of an abandoned estancia, a quadrangle of mud buildings and the remains of some sheep pens. No one in the truck bed moved. The captain opened the door and stepped out. "Vámonos," he said. They climbed down with their guns. Blevins looked about at the ruined buildings.
"What's here?"
he said. One of the guards leaned his rifle against the truck and sorted through the ring of keys and reached and unlocked the chain and threw the loose ends up onto the truck bed and picked up the rifle again and gestured for the prisoners to get down. The captain had sent one of the guards to scout the perimeter, and they stood waiting for him to come back. The charro stood leaning against the front fender of the truck, with one thumb on his carved leather belt, smoking a cigarette.
"What do we do here?" said Blevins.
"I don't know," said John Grady. The driver hadn't gotten out of the truck. He was slumped back in the seat with his hat over his eyes and looked to be sleeping.
"I gotta take a leak," said Rollins.
They walked out through the grass, Blevins hobbling after them. No one looked at them. The guard came back and reported to the captain, and the captain took the guard's rifle from him and handed it to the charro, and the charro hefted it in his hands as if it were a game gun. The prisoners straggled back to the truck. Blevins sat down a little apart, and the charro looked at him and then took his cigarette from his mouth and dropped it in the grass and stepped on it. Blevins got up and moved to the rear of the truck where John Grady and Rollins were standing.
"What are they going to do?"
he said. The guard with no rifle came to the rear of the truck.
"Vámonos,"
he said. Rollins raised up from where he was leaning on the bed of the truck.
"Solo el chico," said the guard.
"Vámonos."
Rollins looked at John Grady.
"What are they going to do?" said Blevins.
"They ain't going to do nothing," said Rollins.
He looked at John Grady. John Grady said nothing at all. The guard reached and took Blevins by the arm.
"Vámonos,"
he said.
"Wait a minute," said Blevins.
"Están esperando,"
said the guard. Blevins twisted out of his grip and sat on the ground. The guard's face clouded. He looked toward the front of the truck where the captain stood. Blevins had wrenched off one boot and was reaching down inside it. He pulled up the black and sweaty inner sole and threw it away and reached in again. The guard bent and got hold of his thin arm. He pulled Blevins up. Blevins was flailing about trying to hand something to John Grady.
"Here,"
he hissed. John Grady looked at him.
"What do I want with that?"
he said.
"Take it,"
said Blevins. He thrust into his hand a wad of dirty and crumpled peso notes, and the guard jerked him around by his arm and pushed him forward. The boot had fallen to the ground.
"Wait," said Blevins, "I need to get my boot."
But the guard shoved him on past the truck, and he limped away, looking back once, mute and terrified, and then going on with the captain and the charro across the clearing toward the trees. The captain had put one arm around the boy, or he put his hand in the small of his back, like some kindly adviser. The other man walked behind them, carrying the rifle, and Blevins disappeared into the ebony trees, hobbling on one boot, much as they had seen him that morning coming up the arroyo after the rain in that unknown country long ago. Rollins looked at John Grady. His mouth was tight. John Grady watched the small, ragged figure vanish, limping among the trees with his keepers. There seemed insufficient substance to him to be the object of men's wrath. There seemed nothing about him sufficient to fuel any enterprise at all.
"Don't you say nothing," said Rollins.
"All right.
Don't you say a damn word."
John Grady turned and looked at him. He looked at the guards, and he looked at the place where they were, the strange land, the strange sky.
"All right," he said, "I won't."
At some time, the driver had got out and gone off somewhere to inspect the buildings. The others stood, the two prisoners, the three guards in their rumpled suits, the one guard with no rifle squatting by the tire. They waited a long time. Rollins leaned and put his fists on the truck bed and laid his forehead down and closed his eyes tightly. After a while, he raised up again. He looked at John Grady.
"They can't just walk him out there and shoot him," he said. "Hellfire, just walk him out there and shoot him."
John Grady looked at him. As he did so, the pistol shot came from beyond the ebony trees. Not loud, just a flat sort of pop, then another. When they came back out of the trees, the captain was carrying the handcuffs.
"Vámonos,"
he called. The guards moved.
One of them stood on the rear axle hub and reached across the boards of the truck bed for the chain. The driver came from the ruins of the Quinta.
"We're okay," whispered Rollins. "We're okay."
John Grady didn't answer. He almost reached to pull down the front of his hat brim, but then he remembered that they had no hats anymore, and he turned and climbed up on the bed of the truck and sat, waiting to be chained. Blevins' boot was still lying in the grass. One of the guards bent and picked it up and pitched it into the weeds. When they wound back up out of the glade, it was already evening, and the sun lay long in the grass and across the shallow swales where the land dipped in pockets of darkness. Small birds come to feed in the evening cool of the open country flushed and flared away over the grass tops, and the hawks, in silhouette against the sunset, waited in the upper limbs of a dead tree for them to pass. They rode into Saltillo at 10 o'clock at night, the populace out for their paseos, the cafes full. They parked on the square opposite the cathedral, and the captain got out and crossed the street. There were old men sitting on benches under the yellow lamplight having their shoes polished, and there were little signs warning people off the tended gardens. Vendors were selling paletas, frozen fruit juices, and young girls with powdered faces went hand in hand by pairs and peered across their shoulders with dark, uncertain eyes. John Grady and Rollins sat with their blankets pulled about them. No one paid them any mind. After a while, the captain came back and climbed into the truck, and they went on again. They drove through the streets and made stops at little dim-lit doorways and small houses and tiendas until nearly all the parcels in the bed of the truck had been dispersed and a few new ones taken aboard. When they pulled up before the massive doors of the old prison on Castellar, it was past midnight. They were led into a stone-floored room that smelled of disinfectant. The guard uncuffed their wrists and left them, and they squatted and leaned against the wall with their blankets about their shoulders like mendicants. They squatted there for a long time. When the door opened again, the captain came in and stood looking at them in the dead flat glare of the single bulb in the ceiling overhead. He was not wearing his pistol. He gestured with his chin, and the guard who'd opened the door withdrew and closed the door behind him. The captain stood, regarding them, with his arms crossed and his thumb beneath his chin. The prisoners looked up at him. They looked at his feet. They looked away. He stood watching them for a long time. They all seemed to be waiting for something, like passengers in a halted train. Yet the captain inhabited another space, and it was a space of his own election and outside the common world of men. A space privileged to men of the irreclaimable act, which, while it contained all lesser worlds within, it contained no access to them. For the terms of election were of a piece with its office, and once chosen, that world could not be quit. He paced. He stood. He said that the man they called the Charo had suffered from a failure of nerve out there among the ebony trees beyond the ruins of the Estancia, and this a man whose brother was dead at the hand of the assassin Blevins, and this a man who had paid money that certain arrangements be made, which the captain had been at some pains himself to make.
"This man came to me. I don't go to him. He came to me, speaking of justice. Speaking of the honor of his family. Do you think men truly want these things? I don't think many men want these things. Even so, I was surprised. I was surprised. We have no death here for the criminals. Other arrangements must be made. I tell you this because you will be making arrangements yourself."
John Grady looked up.
"You are not the first Americans to be here," said the captain. "In this place. I have friends in this place, and you will be making these arrangements with these peoples. I don't want you to make no mistakes."
"We don't have any money," said John Grady. "We ain't fixing to make any arrangements."
"Excuse me, but you will be making some arrangements. You don't know nothing."
"What did you do with our horses?"
"We're not talking about horses now. Those horses must wait.
The rightful owners must be found of those horses.
Rawlins stared bleakly at John Grady.
Just shut the hell up, he said. He can talk, said the captain. It is better when everybody is understand. You cannot stay here, in this place. You stay here, you're going to die. Then come other problems. Papers is lost, peoples cannot be found. Some peoples come here to look for some man, but he is not here. No one can find these papers, something like that. You see, no one wants these troubles. Who can say that somebody was here? We don't have these bodies. Some crazy person, he can say that God is here. But everybody knows that God is not here.
The captain reached out with one hand and rapped with his knuckles against the door.
You didn't have to kill him, said John Grady. ¿Cómo?
You could have just brought him back. You could have just brought him on back to the truck. You didn't have to kill him. A key ring rattled outside. The door opened. The captain held up one hand to an unseen figure in the partial dark of the corridor.
Momento, he said.
He turned and stood studying them.
I will tell you a story, he said, because I like you. I was a young man like you, you see. And this time I tell you I was always with these older boys because I want to learn everything. So on this night at the fiesta of San Pedro in the town of Linares in Nuevo León, I was with these boys, and they have some mezcal and everything. You know what is mezcal? And there was this woman. And all these boys is go out to this woman, and they is have this woman. And I am the last one. And I go out to the place where is this woman, and she has refused me because she say I'm too young or something like that. What does a man do? You see, I can no go back because they will all see that I don't go with this woman. Because the truth is always plain, you see. A man cannot go out to do something and then he go back. Why he go back? Because he changed his mind? A man does not change his mind.
The captain made a fist and held it up.
Maybe they tell her to refuse to me, so they can laugh. They give her some money or something like that, but I don't let whores make trouble for me. When I come back, there is no laughing. No one is laughing, you see. That has always been my way in this world. I am the one when I go someplace, then there is no laughing. When I go there, then they stop laughing.
They were led up four flights of stone stairs and through a steel door out onto an iron catwalk. The guard smiled back at them in the light from the bulb over the door. Beyond lay the night sky of the desert mountains. Below them, the prison yard.
Se llama la periquera, he said.
They followed him down the catwalk. A sense of some brooding and malignant life slumbering in the darkened cages they passed. Here and there along the tiers of catwalks on the far side of the quadrangle, a dull light shaped out the grating of the cells where votive candles burned the night long before some santo. The bell in the cathedral tower three blocks away sounded once with a deep and oriental solemnity. They were locked into a cell in the topmost corner of the prison. The iron-barred door clanged shut and the latch rattled home. And they listened as the guard went back down the catwalk, and they listened as the iron door shut, and then all was silence. They slept in iron bunks chained to the walls on thin trocheros, or mattress pads that were greasy, vile, infested. In the morning they climbed down the four flights of steel ladders into the yard and stood among the prisoners for the morning lista. The lista was called by tiers, yet it still took over an hour, and their names were not called.
I guess we ain't here, said Rawlins.
Their breakfast was a thin pozole and nothing more, and afterward they were simply turned out into the yard to fend for themselves. They spent the whole of the first day fighting, and when they were finally shut up in their cell at night, they were bloody and exhausted, and Rawlins' nose was broken and badly swollen. The prison was no more than a small, walled village, and within it occurred a constant seethe of barter and exchange in everything from radios and blankets down to matches and buttons and shoe nails, and within this bartering ran a constant struggle for status and position. Underpinning all of it, like the fiscal standard in commercial societies, lay a bedrock of depravity and violence, where in an egalitarian absolute, every man was judged by a single standard, and that was his readiness to kill. They slept, and in the morning it all began again. They fought back to back, and picked each other up and fought again. At noon, Rollins could not chew.
"They're going to kill us," he said.
John Grady mashed beans in a tin can with water till he'd made a gruel out of it and pushed it at Rollins. "You listen to me," he said. "Don't you let 'em think they ain't going to have to. You hear me? I intend to make 'em kill me. I won't take nothing less. They either got to kill us or let us be. There ain't no middle ground."
"There ain't a place on me that don't hurt."
"I know it. I know it, and I don't care." Rollins sucked at the gruel. He looked at John Grady from over the rim of the can.
"You look like a goddamn raccoon," he said.
John Grady grinned crookedly. "What the hell you think you look like?"
"Shit if I know."
"You ought to wish you looked as good as a coon."
"I can't laugh. I think my jaw's broke."
"There ain't nothing wrong with you."
"Shit,"
said Rollins. John Grady grinned. "You see that big old boy standing yonder has been watching us?"
"I see the son of a bitch."
"See him looking over here?"
"I see him."
"What do you think I'm fixing to do?"
"I got no idea in this world."
"I'm going to get up from here and walk over there and bust him in the mouth."
"The hell you are."
"You watch me."
"What for?"
"Just to save him the trip." By the end of the third day, it seemed to be pretty much over. They were both half-naked, and John Grady had been blindsided with a sock full of gravel that took out two teeth in his lower jaw, and his left eye was closed completely. The fourth day was Sunday, and they bought clothes with Blevins' money, and they bought a bar of soap and took showers, and they bought a can of tomato soup and heated it in the can over a candle stub and wrapped the sleeve of Rollins' old shirt around it for a handle and passed it back and forth between them while the sun set over the high western wall of the prison.
"You know, we might just make it," said Rollins.
"Don't start getting comfortable. Let's just take it a day at a time."
"How much money you think it would take to get out of here?"
"I don't know. I'd say a lot."
"I would, too."
"We ain't heard from the captain's buddies in here. I guess they're waiting to see if there's going to be anything left to bail out." He held out the can toward Rollins.
"Finish it,"
said Rollins. "Take it. There ain't but a sip." He took the can and drained it and poured a little water in and swirled it about and drank that and sat looking into the empty can.
"If they think we're rich, how come they ain't looked after us no better?" he said.
"I don't know. I know they don't run this place. All they run is what comes in and what goes out."
"If that," said Rollins.
The floodlights came on from the upper walls. Figures that had been moving in the yard froze. Then they moved again.
"The horn's fixing to blow."
"We got a couple minutes."
"I never knowed there was such a place as this."
"I guess there's probably every kind of place you can think of." Rollins nodded.
"Wouldn't have thought of this one," he said.
It was raining somewhere out in the desert. They could smell the wet creosote on the wind. Lights came on in a makeshift cinder block house built into one corner of the prison wall, where a prisoner of means lived like an exiled satrap, complete with cook and bodyguard. There was a screen door to the house, and a figure crossed behind it and crossed back. On the roof, a clothesline, where the prisoner's clothes luffed gently in the night breeze like flags of state. Rollins nodded toward the lights.
"You ever see him?"
"Yeah, one time. He was standing in the door one evening, smoking him a cigar."
"You picked up on any of the lingo in here?"
"Some."
"What's a poocha?"
"Cigarette butt."
"Then what's a take-a-lotta?"
"Same thing."
"How many damn names have they got for a cigarette butt?"
"I don't know. You know what a papazote is?"
"No, what?"
"A big shot."
"That's what they call the dude that lives yonder?"
"Yeah,
And we're a couple of gabachos.
Bolillos.
Pendejos.
Anybody can be a pendejo, said John Grady. That just means asshole.
Yeah? Well, we're the biggest ones in here.
I won't dispute it. They sat.
What are you thinking about?
Said Rollins.
Thinking about how much is going to hurt to get up from here?
Rollins nodded. They watched the prisoners moving under the glare of the lights.
All over a goddamned horse, said Rollins.
John Grady leaned and spat between his boots and leaned back.
Horse had nothing to do with it, he said.
That night they lay in their cell on the iron racks like acolytes and listened to the silence and a rattling snore somewhere in the block and a dog barking faintly in the distance and the silence and each other breathing in the silence, both still awake.
We think we're a couple of pretty tough cowboys, said Rollins.
Yeah, maybe.
They could kill us any time.
Yeah, I know. 2 days later, the Papazote sent for them. A tall, thin man crossed the quadrangle in the evening to where they sat and bent and asked them to come with him, and then rose and strode off again. He didn't even look back to see if they'd rise to follow.
What do you want to do? Said Rollins.
John Grady rose stiffly and dusted the seat of his trousers with one hand. Get your ass up from there, he said. The man's name was Perez. His house was a single room, in the center of which stood a tin folding table and four chairs. Against one wall was a small iron bed, and in one corner a cupboard and a shelf with some dishes and a three-burner gas ring. Perez was standing looking out his small window at the yard. When he turned, he made an airy gesture with two fingers, and the man who'd come to fetch them stepped back out and closed the door.
"My name is Emilio Perez," he said. "Please sit down."
They pulled out chairs at the table and sat. The floor of the room was made of boards, but they were not nailed to anything. The blocks of the walls were not mortared, and the unpeeled roof poles were only dropped loosely into the topmost course, and the sheets of roofing tin overhead were held down by blocks stacked along their edges. A few men could have disassembled and stacked the structure in half an hour. Yet there was an electric light and a gas-burning heater, a carpet, pictures from calendars pinned to the walls.
"You young boys," he said, "you enjoy very much to fight, yes?"
Rollins started to speak, but John Grady cut him off.
"Yes," he said, "we like it a lot."
Perez smiled. He was a man about 40, with graying hair and mustache, lithe and trim. He pulled out the third chair and stepped over the back of it with a studied casualness, and sat and leaned forward with his elbows on the table. The table had been painted green with a brush, and the logo of a brewery was partly visible through the paint. He folded his hands.
"All this fighting," he said. "How long have you been here?"
"About a week."
"How long do you plan to stay?"
"We never planned to come here in the first place," Rollins said. "I don't believe our plans has got much to do with it."
Perez smiled.
"The Americans don't stay so long with us," he said. "Sometimes they come here for some months, two or three. Then they leave. Life here is not so good for the Americans. They don't like it so much."
"Can you get us out of here?"
Perez spaced his hands apart and made a shrugging gesture.
"Yes," he said, "I can do this, of course."
"Why don't you get yourself out?" said Rollins.
He leaned back. He smiled again. The gesture he made of throwing his hands suddenly away from him like birds dismissed sorted oddly with his general air of containment, as if he thought it perhaps an American gesture which they would understand.
"I have political enemies. What else?" "Let me be clear with you. I do not live here so very good. I must have money to make my own arrangements, and this is a very expensive business. A very expensive business."
"You're digging a dry hole," said John Grady. "We don't have no money."
Perez regarded them gravely.
"If you don't have no money, how can you be released from your confinement?"
"You tell us."
"But there is nothing to tell. Without money you can do nothing."
"But I don't guess we'll be going anywheres."
Perez studied them. He leaned forward and folded his hands again. He seemed to be giving thought how to put things.
"This is a serious business," he said. "You don't understand the life here. You think this struggle is for these things, some shoelaces or some cigarettes.